أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وخاتم أنبيائه ورسله سيدنا وشفيعنا بالقاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي أما بعد فقد قال سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه المجيد وهو أصدق القائلين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها الناس إنا خلقناكم من ذكر وأنثى وجعلناكم شعوبا وقبائل لتعارفوا إن أكرمكم عند الله أتقاكم إن الله عليم خبير صلوات We continue our dialogue on this theme of seeking out balance and moderation in the entirety in all aspects of our lives and today will be the final lecture So to speak, tomorrow we are commemorating the Ashura Day, and we will focus more on the narrative, what unfolded on the plains of Karbala in the year 61 Hijri, on the 10th day of Muharram. Yesterday we talked about the two rival theological schools, known as the Ash'ari and the Mu'tazili. We can find an analogous schools of theology or schools of thought, in Western discourse. Legal positivism is something similar to the Ash'ari school of theology in which they would argue that there is no conceptual connection between law and morality. Law is precisely what has been enshrined either by the state, or in our case, law is exactly what the divine has revealed to us. This would be the philosophy or the theological position of those who are legal positivists. In contrast, the ones who are in favor of free will, the ones who would argue that morality and law are intertwined, it would be known as the natural law theory. And they would argue that no, there is an organic relationship between both ethics and divine legislation, and they are organically connected. In the first school of thought that we talked about, the Ash'ari school of law that talks about preordination, divine determinism, for them, before the existence of revelation, society has no morals. So actually, before you have textual evidence for God to define to us and prescribe to us what is moral or what is immoral, actually you have what you call an amoral society. You don't have morals, because the definition of those who are in favor of legal positivism is that morality is what God dictates, what God commands, what He wills becomes moral because God has said so. And there is no such thing as immorality except when God says not to do something. So prior to divine text, you have no way of identifying yourself by any process, objective process, to come to a conclusion, well, this is moral and this is immoral. This is ethical and this is unethical. Because you don't have any instruments. If you are the other school of law, the Mu'tazili school of law, somebody who prescribes the natural law theory, well, you do have a tool. One is you believe that God is just, and justice is a moral quality that human being is able to fathom and come to a conclusion. And we know that we, by the intellect of reason, we are able to define universal core values. Not the particularities, like I said, but we are able to define in generalities. Would you say, for example, what the sister just narrated in Karbala, it doesn't require, you know, a very profound reasoning capability to come to an understanding or to have a very good conscience, to come to an understanding that it is an act of immorality, brutality. It's an act of inhumanity for a human being to stoop so low, so low. You know, it shows that human being, if he is not trained properly and does not take care of his primacy of reason, it is because reason was not working that in that particular position. How is it possible, imagine, for this kind of events to unfold in front of people's eyes within a span of 50 years? And that's why Janabe Zainab asked a very important question. You know, when they were about to sever the head of Imam Hussein, when he was being arrowed from several forces, the question that he asked Umar ibn Sa'd and his army is that, she said, is there a single Muslim amongst you or not? Very important question. Yes, we are reciting the Shahada. Yes, we are doing the Salat. Yes, we are doing the Adhan. Her question is that, oh, Umar ibn Sa'd and your army, do you really have even one Muslim amongst you who will allow this, the head of Imam Hussein to be severed? And of course, there was silence. And she repeats this a couple of times at least, says Sheikh Mufid. You see, when human reason, when there is no way to distinguish good from bad, virtue from vice, there is always a possibility for degeneration of one's conscience, degeneration of one's values, that we can have something as brutal as what we see in Karbala, that even infants are not laid without being butchered. Therefore, God has given us a tool. God has given us a medium, an instrument to be able to distinguish God from bad. When Imam Sahib al-Zaman reappears, and if we are not given the faculty of being able to discern and make a distinction who is a false claimant and who is the authentic claimant to take this position of the Imam, well, the only possible way is to use human intellect. When the Prophet came and he said, listen, I am the messenger of God, what tools do you have at your disposal to authenticate his prophethood? Because he will say, okay, the Quran came. And the Prophet is saying that, listen, I'm receiving divine revelation, but you don't have any other way of confirming, because the Prophet is saying something. The only way for you to come to a conclusion with a sense of confidence is by the use of the faculty of reason and rationality. Salawat. We want to carry this same kind of an ethical moral model and talk about gender issues. How the women have been treated under the Islamic legal framework, and whether it conforms both to the prophetic norms and also to the Quranic worldview, the Quranic vision. In our understanding, the Mu'tazili school of law, we are not Mu'tazili, but we are very close to them in terms of free will. For us, something is normative if it has a moral, ethical underpinning. The normative force that we have is not because God said so, keep this in mind. The normative force that we are claiming for something that can be legal in Islam, the Sharia, when we say is normative, that means it has moral underpinning. It is not because it is Sharia. It has ethics and morality at its core. Now let's talk about gender, having understood that this is our core. When we talk about women's issues, we need to distinguish two things. There are acts of ibadat, which means prayers and fasting, what we call the relationship between human beings and the divine. In the acts of ibadat, we don't have much disagreement because there is a sense of equality that the Quran has prescribed for us and jurists have not contested. The Quran says, for example, men who pray and women who pray. Men who fast, not like Mr. Bush now. Men who fast, you know, Mr. Bush said, my left hand doesn't know from my right hand. He was going, anyways, vice versa. Men who fast and women who fast. Men who are patient, women who are patient. The Quran tells us in acts of ibadat, in acts of worship, that is the human-divine relationship, we don't have much controversy surrounding the equality of men vis-a-vis women. The crux of the problem that we have when it comes to gender justice in the realm of mu'amalat, human interrelationships in the realm of social society, in terms of law, so economic issues, political issues, social issues, and so on. It's in the realm of horizontal relationship from human to human interrelationships. This is exactly where the female voice that can engage the Quran and begin to provide a female lens in the interpretation of the Quran is missing. Because the Quran up to today, most of the Quranic exegetes, if not all, have used their own lens, the male lens, to try to understand the phenomena of the experience of being a woman. But the Quran was not revealed only to men. Or is it only that men can understand the divine will? Is it the monopoly of men that only you need the men's lens or the men's intellect and only he can be able to fathom what God wants to do, and he should then represent women? Because women, naqisul aql, their aql is deficient, right? So therefore, to be able to understand a complex document like the Quran and to engage in critical evaluation, it is beyond capability of women's intellect because they are so emotional. Did you know? They have certain physiological problems. In the monthly period, they are not reliable, you know. They can do funny things. You can't trust them. They are so irrational. Don't ever give them the right of deciding when they want to separate from their husband. They're emotional people. Well, if this is your opinion, then yes, only the agency of men is able to represent holistically women, authentically women, and begin to mediate the experience of being a woman. And once they have concluded what it means to be a woman and apply the legislation, then they can just transmit them to women and say, listen, these are the prescriptions from God. We have understood your rulings, and this is how you should behave. But this is not how the Quran portrays women. Some of the hadith literature may portray women this way, but the Quran is categorically clear when it comes to gender equity. The Quranic worldview and the hadith worldview have some tension. The Quranic worldview and the legal jurisprudence have some tension. For us, the Quran is the axis. That's the point. For us, the Quran is the judge. The Quran will arbitrate for us. Whenever there is a tension, whenever there is a conflict, we have to invoke the Quran, because the only document that we know in our corpus literature that we know has not been tampered with, has not been distorted, is the Quran without exception. The hadith has been interpolated for sure, and plenty. They were being manufactured in whole scale, in wholesale. Whether on Sunni literature of hadith or Shia. Imagine Abu Huraira, who knew the Prophet only for 3 years, and he has narrated the bulk of the hadith in the Sunni hadith literature. Why not the caliphs? How come you don't have a hadith from Imam Ali? I mean, he said he was the closest to the Prophet in terms he was brought up in the house of the Prophet. He was always with the Prophet. How come you don't find hadith by him? That shows that there was an element of bias. There was an element of prejudice. And human being, no matter how hard he tries, you cannot eliminate that prejudice. And men, how hard we try to understand the phenomena of being a woman, we can never be so neutral, no matter how hard you try. You know? So therefore, if this is the case, then the only document that we have full confidence and full trust, is the Quran. And therefore, whenever there is a conflict, the Quran should be the arbiter. Salawat. Let me give you some examples where there is a clash between the Quranic worldview and how the hadith and the Islamic law has projected women. The Quran talks about marriage as an institution where there is love and compassion. It says, وَمِنْ آيَاتِهِ أَنْ خَلَقَ لَكُمْ مِنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا. Look at the vocabulary of the Quran. It says, one of the divine signs is that God has created from yourselves, anfusakum. Didn't say male, that we have created women from men, anfusakum, from one soul, from yourselves, azwajan, pairs. لِتَسْكُنُوا إِلَيْهَا, We created the marriage so that you will find in your marriage peace and tranquility and contentment. Now imagine, if you regard women as inferior, if we regard women as second-class citizens who should be accepting our orders, well, how can you create peace? Peace and tranquility means that you have a sense of parity. It is not a master-slave relationship, don't you agree? A master-slave relationship does not create affection, does not create love. And God says further, وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّةً وَرَحْمَةً. I have put between this marital couple love, mawadda, enormous amount of love, and rahma. Now imagine if you have this master-slave relationship, do you think that we have that kind of affection, that kind of love, that kind of affinity? You'll be shocked. And I'm surprised, you know, that the literature that we have in law, you won't believe, sometimes talks about women as exactly in terms of the vocabulary of slavery, mamluk. It's so shocking. The Quran has never talked about women as in the vocabulary of mamluk, slaves. And yet, some of the legal jurisprudence, when it talks about the transaction of, it's an act, aqdun nikah, it talks about a kind of a contract of purchase. Isn't it true? Well, maybe it surprised you, but if you read the Islamic legal literature, it is no surprise at all. It says that when you are performing this marital contract, the husband is duty-bound to provide for maintenance, to provide for the expenses of the family and the upkeep of the family. In return, the wife has to provide to the husband that she should be accessible to him all the time in terms of his sexual needs. It's almost like a contract where you are purchasing somebody's availability at all times because you provide for the maintenance and the financial upkeep of the family. You will see it is so undignified, right? It doesn't seem the Quranic ethical worldview, but this is the vocabulary that has been used in the Islamic legal literature. The Quran talks about men and women, hunna libasun lakum wa antum libasun lahunna. Imagine, the Quran equates it. It says, you are the protective armor, meaning for women. You are the protective armor for men, and men are the protective armor for you. Look at the Quranic vocabulary of sense of dignified vocabulary. That you are equal. And armor means many things. No sense of superiority, no sense of inferiority. A kind of equality that both of you are functioning as each other's partner. There's a synergy. By coming together, you are more than what you were separately. It is not a concept of, because I provide for the financial expenses for the family, I have the full right to dictate to you whether you can leave the house or not. One of the rulings in Islamic law is that, because man provides for the financial expenditure, he has the right to make sure that she is available. So if she wants to fast, a mustahab fast, a recommended fast, and the husband says, no, I can't control myself. You know, men are uncontrollable, by the way, in the understanding of law, not the Quran. The Quran regards men as highly moral. They have a sense of their moral sharpness is so good that they are able to restrain themselves from committing vices. But in law, men are uncontrollable. We have to somehow do something not to tempt and entice men, because they are so weak. It's actually an insult to men that we are so weak. Spiritually we are so weak as men. Morally we are so weak. Our moral power, our taqwa, is at such a low level that if I see a woman, I go berserk. I can't control myself. This is the vocabulary, I'm saying, of Islamic law. You may think it is giving more rights to men, But if you really begin to understand the Quranic, the vocabulary of law is actually telling us that your taqwa is so low. Your understanding of God awareness is so weak that you are not able to control yourself. And therefore, Islamic law has to imprison women. Islamic law will have to seclude women because they are the ones who are seducing you. They are the ones who are enticing you. And the only way for us to remove this sense of enticement is to imprison them. And that's why we say the best place for prayers for the woman is where? In her own house. In the Sunni hadith, it says in your own closet. Interesting. The best place and the most praiseworthy place where you get the most thawab is not in a mosque, but in a place that you are recluse and away from tempting men. It is telling us indirectly in the vocabulary of the hadith and law that women are the source of all evil. Isn't it true? By implication, what you are saying is if we can only remove women away from the social plane and somehow seclude them, then everything will be just fine on the plane, on the social moral plane. It is when women comes in the social sphere, this is when the man's palpitation goes haywire. You say palpitation? Isn't it true? I'm saying it in a humorous way, but this is exactly how it is described in the hadith literature. I want to say, not the Quran, be very careful. Quran is something quite different. It's a very different document. You know, that's why I'm saying that Quran should be the arbiter and we need to excavate the ethos. When we don't know the Quranic ethos of justice and equity and fairness and equality, we can make mistakes. So the best place for her is in her own private sphere. Well, how come after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, we see all these women who come for Friday prayers? We see women who are carrying guns. We see women who are now policewomen. They are doing kung fu and karate. What happened? Why? Is it something for your own convenience? That when we decide that women are useful in our particular objectives, we invoke them that now you come in the social plane. But when we dislike them to be in any way interfering or at least threatening male domination, the whole issue is men, patriarchal society does not want to let go of power. This is the bottom line. It has to do with the male domination model that we are not prepared to let go. Why should I? Why should we? When we have things like, for example, it says in one of the hadith that you should always consult your wife on each and every matter, no matter how insignificant it is. It's very good, don't you think? You should. And then the hadith goes further. The reason why you should consult her is because whatever she says, you must do the exact opposite. So the reason why you ask her is to know what not to do. Yes, we have hadith. Of course, the hadith conflicts with the Quran, so we can discard it. But I'm saying the hadith literature, Sunni and Shia, is full of. Let me give you a Sunni hadith. And if I have time, I can really go forever. The hadiths are very amusing in this particular issue of gender because men have fabricated a lot of stuff that is so ludicrous. And I mean, you just begin to think, who can even believe this stuff? But there are people who believe and they give rulings. In the Sunni hadith literature, it says that certain items or certain individuals or objects, if they cross in front of you while you are praying, your namaz is void and batil. They are donkey, a black dog, and a woman. You see what I'm saying? This is how they have been described in the hadith literature. What do you expect? If jurisprudence is based on those kinds of hadith, and the Quran is just left as only 500 verses. There are only 500 legal verses that we are going to rely on. And all the other verses have to do with ethics. This is what I mean, is that the other 5,000 plus verses actually dictate the entire worldview, the entire vision is dictated by the 5,000 plus verses. Not the only 500, but this is the problem that we are facing. Salawat. So because they are inferior, we have defined this now, naqisul aql, one of the hadith says, women are inferior in intellect, naqisul iman, the women's iman is also deficient, and they are also deficient when it comes to their share of inheritance. So we have defined that they are inferior, because they are inferior, they would say, now women's testimony should be equal to half the testimony of men, not because of expertise, it is because gender specific. The issue is not testimony of experts. We are not concerned about expertise. A man who is illiterate, he will have more weight in testimony in the court of law than a woman who is educated at Harvard Law School. It doesn't make a difference. Talking about the worldview of the present-day juridical literature. It is based upon gender, not upon expertise. The Quran is not based like this. The Quran says 2:1, only on financial transactions. When the Quranic verse talks about the issue of, you know, you bring one male witness and you bring two female witnesses if you don't have a male, it's talking about a particular financial transaction that needs to be recorded. How dare we extrapolate from this one particular example and extrapolate from this that in the entirety of all laws, women are 2:1. Do you think it's logical? Really, I mean, seriously. Based upon one particular rule that the Quran says only on financial transactions, now you want to say on all issues dealing with economics, politics, society, whatever it may be, citing the moon. Did you know in Shia law, by the way, not in Sunni law, is a bit different. In Shia law, even if you had 100 women who said, listen, we have seen the moon, and all of them agree, by the way, we can't take your word. But if two adil men, two just men, report to us that we have seen the moon, we can declare the moon for the entirety of the area. Are there any just men? Yeah. All of these, listen, they are all supporting you, I'm sure. And many others. She's looking around. Are they just men? No, believe me. In my experience, most of the brothers share your pain. They share your suffering. They share the insensitivity and the oppression and the injustice that has been done to you. Most of the men that I have confronted, at least in my experience in the West. Of course, there are some who say, listen, how can we shut you up? What does it take? You are creating trouble for us at home. Did you know yesterday I had to sleep in the garage? Okay, maybe it's good for a while. But majority are quite happy to listen, because, you know, human conscience realizes, believe me, that there is an element of injustice somewhere. Let me give you an example of injustice that men know. Men have a right to unilaterally divorce their wife or wives, without even informing them, and for any reason they so desire. Doesn't have to be justifiable, it doesn't have to be valid. The wife could be just ideal, perfect, she has no faults, but I want to have somebody else. And I don't have morals and ethics, because morality and ethics is not important. I go by law. Law gives me power. Islamic law gives me power. I can divorce as many women as I like without any just cause, because morality is not connected here. So imagine you wake up one morning and you say, you know what? That's it, I want to divorce my wife. And she has gone shopping in Dubai. Actually, one lady had gone shopping, the shop, it's good to shop. And he sent her an SMS message, consider yourself divorced. Finished. Simple as that. A woman who is being battered by her husband, there is conjugal violence. She is the victim of violence, wife beating. It's one of the very ill disease. But it happens. We say men are so emotionally controlled. Well, men beat up their wives. Look at the statistics. Even though we have the policy of zero tolerance in America, many cases of wife beating. Well, men are so intellectual. Men are supposed to be so thinking. They never lose the emotion. It's women who lose emotions. Isn't it true? Men are ruling the world. They have created mess. They have created chaos. And they say, well, if you have emotion, somehow you will not be able to govern. I think maybe we need some element of compassion. Rahm. You know, Rahm is the womb of the mother. We need, I think, some element of compassion and kindness and mercy in our world that is so cruel. Our world has become so insensitive. Our world has become so cruel, so inhumane. We can kill each other under the flag of religion. Maybe we need some emotion. I think Imam Hussein is full of emotion. What is wrong with emotion? There's nothing wrong with emotion if it is balanced properly with intellect. So to discard women and say, listen, they are so emotional, and that's why we don't give them the right to divorce. So a wife who is being beaten, do you think she can divorce her husband and say, listen, I've had enough with you now? Can she do that? No. What does she have to do? She has to go and appeal to either the judge, if you're living in an Islamic country, or you go and appeal to the wakil of the Ayatollah, the Maraji. You will go and talk with the wakil and say, listen, this has happened, the husband, he also has to ask the husband. The issue is, where are your witnesses? Well, he doesn't beat me up when there are people watching, you know. I think it's normal. You need verifiable proof. How does the wakil know that you are saying that maybe you just beat up yourself? So now you have difficulty of proving your case. But let us say now you're able to prove. The husband says, you know, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Yes, I did lose my temper. I got wild. I shouldn't have done this. Very wrong. And I really apologize. Oh, the wakil of Ayatollah so and so. And from now on I will try to be good. The wakil has no right to give a divorce. There has to be multiple attempts made for reconciliation. There has to be arbitrators put in. There has to be every effort made for reconciliation, while the woman will have to stay in a house where there is conjugal violence. You see? The husband can do whatever he likes for no cause. He says goodbye. The wife who has a justified cause, they'll be told that no, you must try your utmost. As a matter of fact, one of the Sunni Mufti, Ibn Abbas, when a woman wrote to him, that's the very sad part, a woman wrote to him, that my wife is beating me, although there are cases, believe me. There have been cases that I'm aware of that poor husband is being beaten up. No, there are cases, by the way. So be very careful, it goes both ways. You don't beat them up either. They wrote to this Mufti and they said, listen, my husband beats me up. Do you give me permission to divorce him or at least listen to my case? He replies that, listen, God says, talaq is the worst kind of halal. Abghadul halal. Yes, we know the hadith. Talaq is the worst kind of halal that God has allowed. And when talaq is recited, says one of the hadith, the arsh of God shakes. Well, if it is so important, how can a man can do it? Put some kind of control on him too. But for men, no. Talaq is abghadul halal, he writes in his response. And therefore, because it is so revolting, you should try to do sabr. Try to exercise patience and perseverance. And inshallah wa ta'ala, God will reward you plentifully. Interesting. What was shocking to me is that the Mufti did not ask, how much violence is it doing to you? Don't you think it's important? If the degree of violence is intolerable, you split. I'm not a scholar, I can't give fatwas, by the way, so don't count on me. But I'm saying that, you know, human conscience says this is not tolerable. Under Islamic, present day Islamic law, you cannot do that. Sunni law or Shi'i law, salawat. So the jurists in Iran, they have come with a creative solution. They say, okay, Islamic law, we are not going to touch. They think it is frozen. even though it conflicts the Quran. They say when you're making your marital contract, they put several conditions on your booklet. In those conditions, the husband is delegating his power and giving the power of attorney to his wife-to-be to divorce him. So for example, he says, if I become alcoholic, I empower my wife as a deputy, as my wakil, to divorce me. In the event that I become, you know, I'm beating up my wife, I empower my wife to become my wakil, and she can divorce me on my behalf. It resolves the problem partly, but the power resides still with the husband. It is that the husband is being forced right now to transfer his power to women. Still, it is not equitable. Because let's say if I say no, he says the husband transfers the right that if ever he becomes polygamous, he has more than one wife, he transfers the right to his wife, the wife can divorce him automatically and be divorced. But do you think it's fair? Is it still equitable? No. The power is still residing in the sphere of men. The men can say, no, I don't want to give up my power. No. For example, you know, I don't know if I should reveal this or not. Oh no, I shouldn't. My wife will get upset. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. By the way, she listens. She told me, what is your website? So I have to be careful. In any event, you see the inequality? You see the inequality? Where is the ethos of justice? Where is the Quranic verse that says we want to create tranquility and peace and harmony? This is the way we create peace at home. It's a master-slave relationship. Another hadith says that the woman cannot step her foot outside the door of the house where she is properly maintained. Meaning to say that the husband provides for the expenses of the household. If he doesn't provide the expenses, then she has a right to exit the house without the permission of the husband. But he's doing all the stuff. She has no right to exit the house. Even if her own father passes away or is very ill. They relate a hadith in which it says, a husband was going away and he told his wife that I'm giving you my instructions and directive. Don't leave the house until I come back. In the process, her father becomes very ill. And she is thinking what to do. On one side, I have to obey my husband. Because remember, obedience to husband is like worshipping God, almost. Right? Prostration, almost like prostrating God. And therefore, I said to myself, says the hadith, I said, okay, I'll wait till he comes back, inshallah. May God give him long life to my father, so at least I can see him before he expires. My husband doesn't come for a longer while and my father passes away and now they are going to bury him. I said to myself, what can I do? At least can I see him in this state before they bury him? I said, no, I should listen to my husband's directive and wait. The burial is even over now, says the hadith. The husband comes back and he says, when the Prophet heard about this lady, the Prophet sent a message to her that God is very pleased with you. You think men made this up? Very likely. It's a made-up story. You think the Prophet would endorse somebody when we talk about وَلَا تَقُلْ لَهُمَا أُفٍ. Don't say to your parents even an uff. Uff is the minutest amount of disrespect that you say in Arabic. The minutest and the lowest. That's what the Quran says, uff. Don't even make a sign. Like sometimes you just make eye. Especially girls, you know, have you seen they can absolutely kill you. They can bury you alive and say not a word. Just by the eye movements and just their gestures. Isn't it true? It says, وَلَا تَكُلْ لَهُمَا أُفٍ وَلَا تَنْهَرْهُمَا. When parents deserve that much respect, that they are almost second to God. It says, respect your parents all the time, unless they ask you to do something that is violating God's law. But yes, in this hadith, it's okay. Your husband is ill. I mean, your father is ill. Your father is being buried. You have no chance of even seeing him. And most likely, the husband would have said yes. Don't you think the husband would have said yes? Of course. Of course. But no, you can't do this because you'll be violating the principle of obedience to the husband, which is almost equal to worshipping God. Salawat. I'm giving you examples because I want to give you a sense of the particular ethos of the hadith that has contaminated the worldview when it comes to gender justice. And this ethos has to be converted to the ethos of the Quran before we can make any progress. No progress can be made as long as the Quran is on the margins, on the fringes. The hadith that I mentioned to you that God said, if I were ever to ask anyone to worship and to prostrate after me, I would have asked wives to prostrate in front of their husband. Why? Because they are indebted to them. You owe men so very much for all that they do for you, that no matter what you do, you can never repay them what you truly owe. That's the argument. Is that no matter what you do, you're always available for him. Whenever he says, honey, come to bed, you're available 24. This is the idea. If she says no, says the hadith, honey, I have a headache. If she says no, says the hadith, the angels begin to curse upon her. Remember the hadith. This is very useful for you, for men. The angels begin to send curses upon her, and the curses will continue till dawn, till the morning. Because the husband was displeased with her. Another hadith says that women who have displeased and disobeyed their husband may not be entitled to paradise. So now even Jannah is at the with the permission of husbands. You see the problem? This hadith about worship, prostrating men, you think it's logical? Why should it be husbands? Are there other people who are much senior in terms of priority of preference than husbands? Why husband? Are there other people who are more worthy of prostration than husbands? Who do you think we should prostrate? Mothers. The hadith says, and mother, it talks about Maryam. When it talks about Mary in the Quran, look at how it talks about her when she's giving birth. Yes, the hadith says that paradise lies beneath the feet of the mother. And the Quran says categorically, be very careful. Never annoy your parents. Of course, the parents should be also respectful of their children. But be very careful. وَلَا تَكُلَّهُمَا أُفٍّ. When they become old, we lose our patience. That, listen, I can't take care of you anymore. We should take care of them to the best of our abilities, right? They took care of us when we were young, right? وَلَا تَكُلَّهُمَا أُفٍّ. So anyways, mother could qualify far more before husbands, don't you think? From the Quranic worldview. This is created hadith, I'm sure. From the Quranic perspective, there is no mention of Rijal. Men are so worthy of reverence and respect. But we do have Quranic verses that talks about respect and reverence for those who are righteous, for those who are pious, gender neutral. أَتْقَاكُمْ. It talks about respect that is due for parents. Doesn't talk about that kind of level of respect for men as husbands. Again, you can discard them. But this is the worldview. If I am a jurist and I have these kinds of hadith at my disposal, certainly it's going to influence the ruling that I will come out of it. Salawat. The women is a source of fitna. This becomes a tool for jurists on many, many, many legal rulings. How come women cannot drive in Saudi Arabia? The answer was, because they create fitna. If they start driving, they are going to again tempt men. These men who are so powerless in terms of moral control will have many accidents. So if they see a woman, I don't know, a woman's face just driving, does it happen to you? I mean, nothing happens in UK. We are all driving in America. I don't see people having accidents. One was, they said, we'll have casualties, accidents, and we'll have fitna. We'll have sedition. We are not that weak, I hope, that if you see lipstick on a woman, you just go berserk. I mean, we are not really. It's really a statement of insult to us. Believe me, it's an insult. In any event, fitna is invoked on many, many, many legal rulings. How come women cannot do this? They will say because of fitna. The verse about wife beating, right? It comes and comes again. That's in chapter 4, verse 34, that talks about that you try to reconcile with your wife. First you try conversation by admonition, then you separate from her, and then lastly, وَيَدْرِبُهُنَّ. The majority, I think all the tafasir that we have seen so far, talks about يَدْرِبُهُنَّ means you can strike her, but don't strike her so hard that you leave red marks. So either use a twig, miswak, or use a feather. I don't know what you can use, but don't leave red marks. That's the point. Some hadith said, don't hit her on the face, because that is undignified. Well, hitting somewhere else, is it dignified? Where do you create this kana'a, this sense of what the Quran says, mawadda, love, wa rahma, mercy, and affection? It is by this kind of stuff. Huh? You think it's a license for wife beating? And how come the husband has the right to be the judge, jury, and executioner? He'll be the judge. He says, okay, I've done my discussion with you. Yes, I've now done enough of separation. I, as a judge, now decide it's time to beat you up. I mean, it's so amazing. It's so illogical that he is a guy, man, who is not, he's not impartial. It's about him. It's about him, and he's angry with his wife. And yet he's given this prerogative that you decide exactly what is the point of deciding now it's time to start beating her. But don't leave any red marks. That's the key. Be very careful. Do you think it's logical? This verse requires an entire series of lectures. So I'm not going to go into it. But certainly it's not, it doesn't mean the way we understand, to strike, to beat up. I once went to a session, you know, where there was this marital dispute, and I was supposed to arbitrate or conciliate with them. And I asked the husband, I hear that you are beating up your wife. Is it true? I thought that if he says something, I can really catch him quickly. He said, yes, I do so, and I don't hide this. He says, I have every divine right to do so. And he brought me the Quranic verse. He said, the Quran has given me a divine license, and who are you to stop me? You see the problems? You misread the Quran out of its ethos. You can do this kind of violence and mutilation to the script. Salawat. Nushuz, the Quranic verse that talks about beating, in quotation, it says, whenever the wife is guilty of nushuz. Nushuz, they translate as what? The exegetes, the mufassirin, or even the English translations. What is nushuz? If the wife is guilty of the violation of nushuz, then you have a license to beat her, in quotation. What does nushuz mean? Any guess? Sorry? I think. Aha. Yeah, yeah. A woman who has a harsh tongue. Yeah. Somebody who has a very harsh tongue. And women can bite you with the tongue sometimes, right? Severely. Yes. Some people have said, it means any kind of disobedience to men. Nushuz mean any kind of disobedience to men, which gives now a license, and men will decide what is disobedience. It doesn't mean disobedience at all, at all. Nushuz, if you look at the Quran itself has another ayah that talks about nushuz of men in the same, with the same word. It doesn't mean disobedience, it means something very different. And therefore be very clear, that men have no right to lay a hand on women under the circumstances that she disobeys me, she doesn't cook for me, I don't know, she doesn't listen to me, she leaves the house without my permission. You have no right to touch her. Right? But to define this requires another lecture or lectures, And I don't want to be very brief because then the video will go out and we can be misread or misunderstood. Salawat. Anyways, that's right. And the idea is just to provoke you. The idea is just to bug you enough that at least you start to get furious. That's enough, and my job is done. I leave. I'm leaving. Just to percolate that sense of anger, that there's injustice. You know, I'm not kidding. Throughout history, unfortunately, all religions, religion has been the tool used by all religions as a major tool for oppressing women. Christianity, Judaism, look at Jewish law. It is very similar to Islamic law. Under Jewish law, it's almost exactly. A woman cannot divorce her husband until and unless they have to ask him, are you now happy that you have been fulfilled? Everything has been done on behalf of your wife. Only then the rabbi can pronounce divorce. It's almost the same. It's a patriarchal, male-dominated legal discourse. Not the Quranic discourse, it's a legal discourse. Just imagine, what was the behavior and the character of the Holy Prophet and compare with the legal rulings? Did the Prophet behave like this? We have no evidence the Prophet ever, ever laid a finger on any of his wives, even though some of them made him very upset that he separated from them for a while. His wives used to challenge him. They used to contest him. We have reports. The Prophet never said, seal your mouth, I am the Prophet of God. Who are you? I throw you. He could have. Never, we have no incident. When he in the last farewell pilgrimage, khutbah, he said, one of the things he told men, be very kind to your women. Look at on one side the law, look at the Prophet in Hudaybiyah. When all the men were not prepared to listen to the Holy Prophet, because they thought the Prophet is compromising. You know, he signed the treaty, and people were very angry with him. And the Prophet asked everyone, now slaughter your animal. And none of his companions were prepared to listen to him because they were angry with his compromise. He says, you have sold us. You have humiliated us in front of the Meccans, the Quraysh. Why did you sign this agreement? Omar was so upset as well, we have reports. He said, I've never doubted your prophecy until today. None of the it's a rebellion. The Prophet looks at them and is so surprised. What does he do? He goes to the tent, his own tent. And he consults his wife. The hadith says, don't consult your wife, except the opposite, of course. Umm Salama is there, he consults his wife. This has happened. I don't know what to do. And she says, as a suggestion, doesn't mean that now you say, okay, she is better than God. But she's giving a proposal that, you know, go and start slaughtering your own animal, zibh. And then when they will see you, Muhammad, they will feel ashamed of rebelling against you, revolting against you, and they will do exactly the same. The Prophet went outside, listened to her advice, surprise, huh? And he did exactly this. The companions were just revolting. He just began to slaughter his own animals. Exactly it happened. The companions felt so ashamed that they have done such insult to the Prophet. They all came, apologized, and the Prophet, we have no report that the Prophet ever criticized them. We have no record, Sunni or Shia in historical narrative, that the Prophet told them, listen, you disobeyed me and I felt hurt. Never. They all apologized, it was over, done deal, and they returned back to Medina. You see the approach of the Holy Prophet, he doesn't hold this kind of grudges as children that we do. So who are we then to talk about mistreating women? Salawat. I think I should stop here and allow for a few questions.
Thank you very much. We'll start with the lady side if there are any questions.
All right.
Any questions from the gents?
Are there any jurists you know of who do follow the Quranic viewpoint on the legal aspects?
Very good question. Yes, there is a movement, like I said, that jurists are beginning to realize that the Quranic ethos perhaps has been compromised, because legal jurisprudence deals with legal corpus of precedents. You see, one of the issues that we have as Shia is that we have such high respect and high reverence of scholars today and in the past, that our respect reaches a level of sanctification that we can't even begin to open up and begin to be critical. Respect is good. Reverence is good. And disagreement does not mean that you don't respect them. Do you agree with me? Disagreement done with proper parameters is not a sign of disrespect. And this is the confusion that we have. So sometimes when we say something that doesn't agree with the present day ruling, they construe this to mean that you have insulted the marja or the maraja. No insult. Like Brother Nazir said yesterday, we have high respect. And why should we just respect maraji? You don't think you should also respect academic scholars? You don't think you should respect those who are, let's say, professional doctors and cardiologists and ilm? Should you not respect knowledge by itself? If you see a knowledgeable person, a physicist, somebody who is curing people, somebody, a doctor who is curing and giving you new life, you don't think we should respect him? You say respect as if it's only for the maraji. I mean, this is the kind of mindset that we have been, somebody has kept this in our mind, that somehow it is so holy. Well, yes, they are religious people. We have religious people all over the place. They can be a surgeon who is equally religious, and perhaps more so than many of us. Piety is not the monopoly of religious people, by the way. Piety is found everywhere. And one can argue, when you are doing things with such sincerity, we have many issues, you know. We have jealousies. As you are in the academy, as we are in the religious circles, we have jealousies. We have issues with ourselves. Sometimes you begin to wonder, the more you climb, maybe the less pious you are becoming sometimes. You begin to worry. Be very careful. Because every, you know, instance of elevation in your respect, you can compromise many things, you know. Power is corrupting, and also powerlessness is corrupting. We don't want to be powerful, all-powerful, and no accountability. At the same time, being powerless is also corrupting. Like I gave you the example of fakr. If you are poor, and somebody is controlling your money, your finances, you can compromise. We don't want powerlessness, and we don't want power. We want to be respected with humility and reverence. Now, what was the question again?
Yes.
Sorry, this is something that I wish Amina is here. Oh, Amina is here, so I know. Okay, so I should be finishing very, very quickly. Yes, there are jurists who have made the Quran as the pivot, qutb, and that's the way it should be. For example, some of the young scholars who are now emerging in Qom. Ayatullah Sani'i, I wrote an article on him, that there is a change of paradigm. For him, the Quran is the pivot. Any hadith that does not agree with the Quranic worldview, he takes the prerogative to leave it aside and move on. So yes, there are scholars who are emerging, and certainly it is going to begin to... Ayatullah Muntazari, on the law of apostasy, irtidad, he said no. If somebody converts from one religion to the other, and they have done so out of conviction, you can't kill him after 3 days. He said, it is un-Quranic. He said, it goes against the Quranic ethos. This is what I mean. This is how jurists should talk. Not because it goes against the hadith, it goes against the Quranic ethos. Yes, so we have, certainly.
Talking about contemporary, I also want to find out if historically we've had that. I mean, if, for example, the contemporary ulama have come up with this viewpoint, surely there might have been in the past as well.
At least not to my understanding or to my knowledge. You know, I mean, I was going to show you actually one of the past scholars. I have him on my computer, but time is up. Nasiruddin al-Tusi, who wrote a book on Tajrid al-I'tiqad, and we still use him, by the way, in the Hawza till today. He's a very good scholar, by the way, a good theologian. One of the best theological texts that we have, that we use till today, like I said, is the book by, not Sheikh Tusi, but Nasir al-Din al-Tusi. And there are so many commentaries by Allama Hilli. You know, we have Kashf al-Murad, and I don't know, Sharh of Tajrid. We have many, many, many commentaries. It's a good work. So as a scholar in theology, he was very good. But his understanding of women was completely convoluted. You read his books dealing with women, I'm saying. His genius, let's say on theology, his genius on other sciences, when it comes to women, it is absolutely unacceptable. You know, he says for women, he says things like, you should always keep women under your awe, under your fear. Because the moment they feel that they're outside your control, they will harass you. He says you should always keep women busy. Give them no free time. The moment they have free time, they are troublemakers. This is a scholar who has written a very good theological text. Till today we can use him. Many things like this in his book. That you feel, that you know that if you have a mindset like this, and now you are a jurist, what kind of legal opinions are you going to get? You see, that's the point. Is that everybody has subjectivities. And if I were to read, you won't believe. You can't believe it's the same Nasir al-Din al-Tusi who wrote this wonderful work of Tajrid. But he's there. So to my recollection, at least to my knowledge, I don't know of any scholar who would have given a ruling different, let's say on divorce, that yes, women can divorce. Ayatollah Sani, by the way, does give permission that yes, women who cannot tolerate the husband, they have every right to divorce unilaterally without this deputization of power. They can divorce and forego the mahar. But they can divorce. Now, I don't want you, all of you, to change to Ayatollah Sani. I'm not promoting, I'm not his wakil, by the way. I get no khums, by the way. No khums comes to me, no khums goes. I'm just talking about present-day scholarship. We have Ayatollah Sayyid Hussain Fadlullah, who is extremely progressive and understands that. He has a very nice book, Dunya al-Mar'a, The World of Our Women. Okay, it's in Arabic, but it's a very interesting book. He's very much sensitive to gender issues and understands the Quranic ethos. Just, this is my opinion. Just an opinion.
Any questions from the lady side?
Just make a comment. Maybe
sure.
Sheikh Tusi or the others will have a fear of their wives.
Could be.
Sheikh Sadi once was writing his poetry, and then his wife opened the door and says, "What are you saying?" And he was frightened. He says, "Zano peygamber, zano ijdaha hardo peygamberan."
Uh-huh. Translate?
Oh, the dragon and the woman, they both are prophet.
Yeah.
Just of the fear of his wife, he said. So perhaps that could be the case.
That's right.
We don't know.
That's right. That's right. It is quite possible that as women become more and more educated, really it makes men nervous. That's why you will see if a woman has, let's say, a higher degree than men, it's very difficult to marry her, right? The reason being, but sometimes it's women's fault too. You should not make him feel inferior. And sometimes women rub it in. You know, that, what do you know, Baba? I have doctorate, you have high school diploma. So of course, if you rub it in, of course, they will not like it. Men also, you know, you have to also understand the nature of men. You know, when we talk about equality, it doesn't mean that, you know, you can bash men too. We are not talking for male domination or, by the way, women domination. We are not male chauvinists. At the same time, we don't want what you call a matriarchy. Patriarchy is bad. Or at the same time, matriarchy, where women are now dominant over men, is also equally wrong. Be very clear. The idea is to find balance. You're saying about al-wasat, moderation. So when I talk in this way, it's because right now the pendulum is so much the other way. That's why I'm beating up men. But it doesn't mean that I'm saying, okay, now you start beating them up. Okay, that's not the point. The point is to find moderation. And you know, asking questions, by the way, you know, you may say, okay, how come we are discussing these kinds of sensitive issues? And We should not talk about these kinds of issues in public, and our public is so naive, and our public has low intelligence. This is the normal argument we get. Whenever we talk about academic issues, real issues that really impact the real Muslim world, the real human beings of today, the argument is, okay, it's good what you say, but talk in private only among scholars. Well, we have tried this for quite some time. It doesn't seem to work. And why can't we speak in public? You guys are very intelligent. I mean, we underestimate the reservoir of intelligence that is out there. I mean, we have certainly trivialized half the intelligence to begin with. So half the population have no intelligence. It's a naqisul aql. So half the humanity is gone. Then the other, I don't know, two-thirds, you want to say, they don't know either because they are not experts, you know. You have left very few now. What do we do? I think the intelligence is out there. And the moment you start discarding people and saying, listen, you are losing it. We are losing our opportunity. Look at the example, then I conclude.
Could I make a comment?
Yes.
I just wanted to make a general comment about this debate. I think when we talk about gender relations or gender justice, particularly in the Islamic framework, I think there is a sense that it's somehow about restoring the position of women, or kind of, in some really crass senses, placating women, or just kind of giving them these rights that have gone missing. And I think a very useful and helpful way to give more momentum to the debate would be to actually look at the fact that if men have too much power, if there's too much indulgence, if they're kind of crossing over the moral line, not through any fault of their own as you've described, but because this is the way that law has been given down, then actually that is an injustice to men as well, because it's an oppression
exactly
of the self.
Exactly,
and I think
what
that
I said.
is really missing from the debate, because I think there's a sense of we're trying to take something away from one part and give it somewhere else, rather than looking at kind of freeing both parts by being more just and equitable between both, and removing that self injustice that comes from too much power.
Absolutely. I think probably you said it better than I did. You see, exactly. You heard her. It's exactly, I think, if you look at this from the perspective of justice, I look from the perspective of spirituality. I talked about that we are so morally and ethically powerless. That has to do with justice. But I think justice is, I think, perhaps a stronger way. That there is an element of injustice done even to men. If everybody regards you as so weak, well, it's injustice to me. I have some dignity. You mean to say if I go to a mosque, and if there is no partition, and women are sitting on one side, men are sitting on the other side, and we have a lecture, somehow the fitna will start. I can't control myself, brothers and sisters. It's an insult. He will say, it is unjust to me. How come you treat me this way? Right? So yes, it is an act of injustice too, but also it's a testimony of a statement about the moral weakness of men. I think that's... How come you think in Egypt we have the highest rate, one of the highest rate of women harassment is in Egypt? Did you know? Yes. You know, one of the highest rate of harassment for women is in Egypt. 80% plus have complained in the poll. Why? Because you are creating this sense of... You see, we are preoccupied with women's body, sexuality, that we have made the whole of Islam almost revolving around this temptations, these enticements. Well, it is one part, but leave it aside. We have many other things in Islam we can talk about. It's not just about marriage and, you know, relationships and these palpitations and all this. There are other things in life. So when you are obsessed, just like young kids, you tell them, don't do this, there's something wrong here, or you'll go astray. Yes, you must have somebody to accompany, otherwise, well, things go wrong then, right? I mean, women in Saudi Arabia, I have a Saudi student, and I asked them, how come they have this concept of burqa? And she said, the burqa is now going to such an extreme that they are saying just one eye now, not two eyes. I don't know. Why? Because it's tempting men. I mean, even the eyes now, you want to take it away? It's tempting men, they say. I think pretty soon they will say, even not the one eye, maybe we should have a dog guiding us. I don't know. Where can you go? It's really injustice to men. I agree with the sister. It's really injustice to say that we are that kind of creatures. Just our hormones is just so imbalanced. Well, get some hormonal medicine, brothers. You know, reduce the, what they call, what is this? Testosterone. Thank you. Yes. There's a question here from the...
I think we'll end the question and answer session later, sorry. So we can continue with the history, inshallah.
I'm so sorry. Inshallah wa ta'ala tomorrow if you have time. One last comment that you can go from this assembly feeling assured that we have done nothing wrong by talking about is our moral, ethical, I believe, not just we haven't done anything wrong, we have done an act of worship, ibadah, is our responsibility. Whenever you see injustice being done, that's the Imam Hussein's message. Whenever there is injustice being done, and it is so vividly clear, there is no element of doubt in my mind, and nor should there be in yours, we need to speak out. You know, we need to speak out. It is not tolerable for us to see injustice and remain completely oblivious of the issues. Nabi Ibrahim, he asked God, and he's a prophet. He says, وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّي أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيَ الْمَوْتَ. Oh God, show me how you give life. He wants evidence. He wants proof. He wants something empirical, logical, rational. You will say he's a prophet of God. Of everybody, the prophet should not ask for any kind of proofs and evidence. When we ask any question, we are being beaten up. What do you know? Everybody else knows, and we will tell you what to do. Well, the prophet is asking Nabi, كَيْفَ تُحْيَ الْمَوْتَ. How do you give life? قَالْ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ, says Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Don't you have iman? Don't you believe in me that I can give life? You are a prophet. We believe he is ma'asum. The reply, Kala, bala, of course I do, with all definitiveness. Walakin liyatma'inna qalbi. That's the key. Qalb, conscience. Yes, but I want to give further reassurance to my heart, qalb. Qalb is the receptacle for human intellect as well, qalb. Qalb is the receptacle of human conscience. So if the prophet can ask questions from God, and then God was able to bring birds and resurrect them. You can read the story in the Quran in chapter 2. So what we are doing is exactly what the Quran wants us to do. Salawat. We want to remember the youngest of all who had joined Imam Hussein, and very correctly the sister pointed out that his presence is explicit evidence for us that Imam Hussein was not engaging for power gain, for power accumulation. He was there for something very different. He was there to promote the ideals of the Quran based upon justice, fairness, and equity. On the last eve, this is the 9th of Muharram, Imam Hussein knows that tomorrow will be the last day because they have been told. The army of Umar ibn Sa'd had begun to confront Imam Hussein, and he sends Abbas to find out what's happening. And Abbas finds out that they have received instructions to start warfare. And Imam tells Abbas, go and get one day extension, one night extension, a layla. One night extension so that we can remember God, we can recite the Quran, we can ask for forgiveness, we can pray to God. This is the ma'asum Imam who feels that he needs one day of prayers. In the pitch of the night, he tells his companions like this. He says, "Uthni ala Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala ahsana thuna." He begins by praising God. Oh God, I praise you, the most exalted, with the best of glorification. Somebody who is in this state of difficulty, you begin with tawheed. Tawheed. Wa ahmadahu ala sarra'i wa darra'i. I praise you in times of prosperity, goodness, and also in difficult days, God, I praise you. My praise and glorification for you is not conditional upon whether you have given me this or that. I praise you, God. Allahumma inni ahmaduka ala an akramtana bin nubuwa. Oh God, I praise you because you have given us this nobility of prophethood. I praise you, O God. Wa allamtana al-Qur'an. You have given us the teachings of the Qur'an. I praise you. We praise you, O God, says Imam Hussein, that you have given us depth in understanding our religion from faqih. Wa faqahtana fid-deen. You have given us profound understanding of our religion. Wa ja'alta lana asma'an wa absaran wa af'ida. You have made us seeing with sight, with hearing, and we also have a heart. Af'ida means conscience. Amma ba'd, he tells his companions and family members, فَإِنِّي لَا أَعْلَمُ أَصْحَابًا أَوْفَى وَلَا خَيْرًا مِنْ أَصْحَابِي. I don't know of any followers who have been as faithful to me and as kind to me as you are. Not even Battle of Uhud. وَلَا أَحْلَ بَيْتِي أَبَرَّ وَأَوْسَلَ مِنْ أَحْلَ بَيْتِي. I know of no family who has been this generous and kind to me and close-knit as you have been. فَجَزَاكُمُ اللَّهُ أَنِّي جَمِيعًا خَيْرًا. I pray to God for all of you that may God give you plenty of reward. أَلَا وَإِنِّي أَظُنُّ يَوْمَنَا مِنْ هَؤُلَاءِ الْأَعْدَاءِ غَدًا. I think tonight is our last night. And tomorrow, I think, will be the final day of confrontation. أَلَا وَإِنِّي قَدْ أَذِنْتُ لَكُمْ. I give you permission to leave me. فَانْتَلِقُوا جَمِيعًا. All of you are free to go. فِي حِلٍّ لَيْسَ عَلَيْكُمْ مِنِّي ذِمَامٌ. Don't feel guilty that I'm keeping you and we have this bond of allegiance. I'm freeing you from that contract. أَلَا وَإِنِّي قَدْ أَذِنْتُ لَكُمْ فَانْتَلِقُوا جَمِيعًا فِي حِلٍّ لَيْسَ عَلَيْكُمْ مِنِّي ذِمَامٌ. هَذَا اللَّيْلُ قَدْ غَشِيَكُمْ فَاتَّخِذُوهُ جَمَلًا ثُمَّ لِيَأْخُذْ كُلَّ رَجُلٍ مِنْكُمْ بِيَدِ رَجُلٍ مِنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتٍ ثُمَّ تَفَرَّقُوا فِي سَوَادِكُمْ. He says, take this night as your cover. And within this cover, hold the hands of each other and rescue yourself away from this place in any part of the world that you can find safety. حَتَّى يُفَرِّجُ اللَّهَ فَإِنَّ الْقَوْمَ إِنَّمَا يَطْلُبُونِ. You will find safety and security because these people are desirous only of me, of my blood. Look at the reply of these people who have been tested and mentored by the Hussein. Imam Hussein tells the sons of Aqil, حَسْبُكُمْ مِنَ الْقَتْلِ بِسَاحِبِكُمْ مُسْلِمْ اِذْهَبُوا فَكَدْ أَذِنْتُ لَكُمْ. He says to his sons, listen, it's enough. The sacrifice your father made for this cause and for me, you know, is really enough. اِذْهَبُوا. You should go. And I've given you permission to go. Look at the reply. Youngsters. They said, absolutely, it is impossible, O Hussein ibn Ali, for us to leave you. Abbas spoke out. Muslim ibn Awsaja says, أَنَحْنُ تُخَلِّ أَنْكَ وَقَدْ أَحَاتَ بِكَ حَاذَ الْعُذْرِ فَبِمَا نَعْتَذِرُ إِلَى اللَّهِ فِي أَدَاءِ حَقِّكَ. Can we leave you alone in this state when you are surrounded by enemies? And can we truly face us ourselves in front of God? لا والله, it's impossible. وَلَوْ لَمْ يَكُنْ مَعِي سِلَاحٌ أُقَاتِلُهُمْ بِهِ لَقَذَفْتُمْ بِالْحِجَارَةِ. If my sword even breaks and I have no arrows, I will fight with them with stones to protect you. حَتَّى أَمُوتُ مَعَكَ. Until I lose my life, I will try to protect you. لَا وَاللَّهِ يَبْنَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. O the son of the messenger, لَا نُخَلِّيكَ حَتَّى يَعْلَمُ اللَّهِ أَنَّ قَدْ حَفِظْنَاهَا غَيْبَةَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ فِيهِ. We will not leave you, O son of the messenger, until we know that in the absence of the Prophet, we have tried to preserve his son to the best of our ability. وَاللَّهِ لَوْ عَلِمْتُ أَنِّي أَقْتُلُ ثُمَّ أُحْيَى ثُمَّ أُحْرَقُ حَيًّا ثُمَّ أَدْرِي يُفْأَلُ ذَلِكَ بِي سَبْعِينَ مَرَّةً مَا فَارَقْتُكَ حَتَّى أَلْقَى جِبْهِمَامِ دُونَكَ. He says that even if I knew that I was going to be killed and then brought to life and then burnt and then brought to life. And this process was to continue for 70 times. It is not possible for us to leave you. فَكَيْفَ لَا أَفْأَلُ ذَلِكَ وَإِنَّمَا هِيَ قَتْلَةٌ وَاحِدَةٌ. How is it possible for us to leave you when we know that this happens only once? Impossible. Zuhair ibn Qain, وَاللَّهِ يَبْنَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ لَوَدَدْتُ أَنِّي قُتِلْتُ ثُمَّ نُشِرْتُ ثُمَّ قُتِلْتُ حَتَّى أُقْتَلَ قَذَا أَلْفَ مَرَّةٌ. Not possible, Imam. Even this happens repeatedly. Brothers and sisters, these were no empty, hollow slogans that we give out. That we are here. We say in Ziyarat al-Warisa, that if I was there with you, فَأَفُوزَ فَوْزًا عَظِيمًا فَكُنْتُ, I would have given up my life, O Imam, in this noble cause. These are statements, but the brothers who made these seven sisters, these were no slogans. In the process, once he has said this to the companions and to his messengers, Imam Hussein goes to his tent and he begins to recite a few words of poetry at the night. He says, مَا دَحْرُ أُفٍ لَكَ مِنْ خَلِيلٍ. He says, fie upon you, shame on you, time. مَنْ صَاحِبٍ أَوْ طَالِبٍ قَتِيلٍ. You kill those who seek you and your companions. وَالدَّحْرُ لَا يَكْنَأُ بِالْبَدِيلِ. That the time is not content with anybody to exchange in terms of somebody's life. When Zainab heard this, says Imam Zainul Abidin, she understood that Imam is talking about the approaching death. And she gets very sentimental and emotional, and she is not able to control her emotion, is quite understandable. And she begins to screech out and tears part of her clothes. The Imam tells her, balance, balance. Ya ukhayya ittaqillah wa ta'izzi bi'aza'illah. Be mindful of God, O sister. وَعَلَمِي أَنَّ أَهْلَ الْأَرْضِ يَمُوتُونَ وَأَنَّ أَهْلَ السَّمَاءِ لَيَبْقُونَ. You know, of course, that the entire earth, nothing is going to stay. The entire skies will not stay forever. وَأَنَّ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ حَالِكَ. Everything is going to perish. إِلَّا وَجْهَ اللَّهِ. Except the face of God. الَّذِي خَلَقَ الْأَرْضَ بِقُدْرَتِهِ. He is the one who created the earth. He is the one who will perish it. وَيَبْأَثُ خَلْقٍ. And he is the one who will resurrect. فَيَعُودُونَ وَهُوَ فَرْضٌ وَحْدَ. He'll bring us back to life. أَبِي خَيْرٌ مِنِّي. Our grandfather and our brother, my brother, was better than me. He speaks about him. وَأَخِي خَيْرٌ مِنِّي. My brother was better than me. وَلِي وَلَهُمْ وَلِكُلِّ مُسْلِمٍ بِرَسُولٍ Birasulillah uswa. And in comparison to all the believers and even these imams, the Prophet was our example. So all of us are going to die. He says to her, Ya ukhayya, O my sister, Inna uqsimu alayka fa abriya qasami. He says, I'm taking an oath, my sister. And I don't take oaths easily. You must respect this oath. La tushakka alayya Jaiban, do not tear your clothes, tear off your clothes. وَلَا تَخْمُشِي عَلَيَّ وَجْهَ. Do not scratch your faces. وَلَا تَدِي عَلَيَّ بِالْوَيْلِ وَالثُّبُورِ إِنْ حَلَقْتِ. Do not screech out and scream in grief and sorrow, even when I pass away. Moderation. The next day arrives, and after having lost all his companions and all his family members, he goes to the tent after recovering all these bodies throughout the day. And Imam Hussein sees this infant who is suffering from this scorching heat and acute thirst. He says, let me try. Maybe the army of Umar ibn Sa'd must have some conscience. They are creation of God. I'm saying, he must have thought that yes, these people cannot be that cruel. Whatever they have against me is me. If they want to take revenge because some of the people were killed in battle of Uhud and battle of Hunain, and they want to take revenge and vendetta in the Arab culture, it has to do with me. If they are angry with me that I am not giving the pledge of allegiance, bay'ah to Yazid, and they want to shed my blood, it has to do with me. Nothing to do with this innocent infant child, Ali Asghar, whose real name is Ar-Radi. Abdullah, he says, let me take him, At-Tifl. And he goes and tells them, raises him up in the air and says, مَا شَرِبَ الْمَا فَاطْلُبُ لَهُ شَرْبَةً مِنَ الْمَا فَأَخَذَ الطِّفْلُ وَتَوَجَّهُ نَحْوَ الْقَوْمِ. He raises them and shows him the Ali Asghar to bring about the reawakening of the conscience. وقال يا قوم قد قتلتم أخي وأولادي وأنصاري وما بقي غيرهم الطفل. You have killed my brothers and my members of the family and my companions. The only thing left for me is now this infant child. وهو يتلظى عطشا. He is dying of scorching thirst. فَسْقُوهُ شَرْبًا. Give him a drink. مِنَ الْمَاءِ. فَبَيْنَمَا هُوَ يُخَاطِبُهُمْ إِذْ أَتَاهُ سَحْمٌ مَشُومٌ مِنْ ذَالِمٍ غَشُومٌ فَضَبَحَ الطِّفْلُ مِنَ الْأُذْنِ إِلَى الْأُذْنِ. There is a sense of commotion in the other side, and they realize that if this continues, maybe the conscience of the Umar ibn Sa'd may come back to life. In the fear of this conscience that can reappear, he gives the order to Hurmala that, you know, send out this spear and make sure that you get this child so this commotion can come to an end. And he does exactly this. The blood comes on the fingers of Hussein, we are told, and as it fills his hand, فَجَعَلَ الْحُسَيْنِ يَتَلَقَّ الدَّمْ بِكَفَّيْهِ وَيَرْمَى بِهِ إِلَى السَّمَاءِ. He throws it towards the sky. وَيَكُولَ اللَّهُمَّ إِنِّي أَشْهَدْ. O God, bear witness that these people who are opponents have tried to kill and have spared nobody from the family of your holy prophet. فَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْكَلِبٍ يَنْكَلِبُونَ. مَاتَمَ حُسَيْنَ.